This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
You know, there are a lot of passions. Some days it's sports, other days it's cooking or music, or just diving into a great documentary. The thing is, whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Amazon Prime isn't just about fast delivery. Though getting stuff the same day is pretty great, but it turns out it's so much more. Prime Video, Amazon Music, the whole range of services. It's like a hub for all kinds of curiosity. Prime helps people stay connected to what matters and keeps the journey of exploration going, whether it's watching something inspiring, listening to a new artist, or getting gear delivered fast to chase a new hobby. Prime makes it easier to dive in. So yeah, whatever you're into, it's on Prime. From streaming to shopping, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever sparks interest. Amazon.com/Prime.
Game day or any day, your fit says it all. Hit up MLBShop.com for the latest jerseys, caps, hoodies, and accessories to keep you in the game all year long. Rep your team, rep your city, rep yourself. Gear up and game on at MLBShop.com, the official online shop of Major League Baseball. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Well, actually, Dave got off at 6 o'clock. I recently started working at 6 o'clock, like about 20 years ago. But anyway, so I chose this Aretha Franklin song for the bumper music on purpose because I don't know what's going on with tariffs. I don't know if one side's trying to play the other or people are reacting or there is no big plan. I have no earthly idea. But Patrick Penfield, our friend, professor of supply chain practice at Syracuse University, joins us now to talk about the U.S. and China and tariffs. How you doing, Professor?
I'm doing well, Tommy. How are you doing?
I'm okay. I don't understand what's going on with China. Where does the whole tariff thing stand now? With whom?
Yeah, so, Tommy, so the U.S. has collected over $150 billion in tariffs since 2025. Beginning of 2025, in all of 2024, we collected $77 billion. So right now there is this issue, this negotiation that's going on between the U.S. and China.
So that's money for the U.S. Treasury just to follow the money. Where did the money come from? Do we know?
Yeah, the money's going to be coming from U.S. businesses. So they pay whatever comes in that they import, they pay that tax, and that goes to the U.S. Treasury.
Businesses, not consumers yet?
Not yet, Tommy. So I think, it's all about inventory. And I think for the most part, we're starting to see some of that stuff. Some of your listeners probably are seeing that at the grocery store and at the department stores. So it's starting to come. And there was 3% or 2.7% is what the inflation rate was overall for July. So, yeah, absolutely. The prices are starting to go up. And I'm starting to see that when I'm out there shopping. You know, again, I just see things being more expensive.
And that's what I was thinking about with this 90-day pause, because it seems to me whoever's playing the long game here, if anybody's playing the long game, by pausing in another 90 days, it would give people a chance to load up on inventory to delay the effect of tariffs. Yes or no?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's going to happen. So the big issue, it's you know, in negotiations, it's about leverage and who has leverage. And China has a lot of leverage, and specifically with rare earth and magnets.
Because of the natural resources that they have?
Yeah, so they mine about 60 to 70% of the rare earth minerals and resources, and then they process and refine 90% of the world's rare earth magnets. So you need this stuff in for all your electronics, your defense systems, your clean energy, your medical technology. So it's a really, really important minerals that you have to have, and China controls that. So the U.S. is really kind of in a situation here where China has leverage. And so this is, I think, the primary reason for the pause.
So if that's the day, if that's the thing, magnets and rare earth, and only China has them, is that right?
Yeah, because they process and refine 90%. It's really a dirty process. It's, again, from the environmental standpoint, it's not really good. You have to have special equipment, and they control it.
So is that business that we would really want here in the United States?
It's not just want, Tommy. We have to have it. So if we don't have it, we can't make medical machines. We can't make electronics. We can't, you know, do anything with our defense systems. So they really kind of have us over the barrel in regards to rare earth magnets.
But maybe I didn't phrase the question correctly. What I mean is, if the idea behind tariffs is not to raise money for the Treasury, as it was in the McKinley days, but with President Trump to bring manufacturing to the United States, and then China controls 90% of these rare earth magnets, is that what we're calling it?
Rare earth and magnets. Yeah,
rare earth and magnets. So how could that ever come to the United States? Because it seems at one point or the other we have to import it from China. How could that manufacturing process come in?
Yeah, I mean, if we are to do that, and probably is in our best interest someday or somebody else to do it, it would make sense to try to do that. But it's going to be really difficult to do so. And I think that's one of those things where you want to try to control what you have. So from President Trump's perspective, I would look to see if there is ways to go someplace else or possibly do that in the United States eventually, because this is really, really critical resources that we need in order to operate our manufacturing.
So could the United States wolf China on this and just say, you know what, forget it, we're going to take over that business ourselves? But if they did, who else has these magnets and rare earth materials? Or does the United States have them, even though it would be a dirty business? Can we get into it? That's what I'm trying to understand.
Yeah, so they mine about 60 to 70% of the rare earth minerals that are processed and refined.
Okay.
So there are other areas where you could get that, really difficult to get. And we can actually mine our own here in the United States. But again, really difficult to start that process. And then you have to figure out how do we refine and process it? How do we manufacture it? And that would be expensive, and that would be timely and costly.
So if that's the case, and this goes to... And we'll take a break here and pick it up when we come back. This goes to long-term commitment when it comes to manufacturing in the United States, and I'm all for it. We'll take a look at what tariffs have produced so far. I understand it's produced a lot of promises from companies, but that makes me wonder again about who's zooming who with. Are the companies promising this to try to get tariffs taken off for now when, in fact, they're just trying to wait out the Trump administration because they think the next administration may not feel that way? And also, if the next administration doesn't feel as President Trump feels, well, then they can't spend all that capital investment when all of a sudden China's going to start beating them again with the price. We'll talk about long-term and everything else when we come back. 620 Traffic, WWL. Tommy Tucker, WWL 626, talking to our friend Patrick Penfield, professor of supply chain management at Syracuse University, supply chain practice at Syracuse University, about tariffs. So before we went to the break, I was asking about long game here, and the plan for President Trump is not, as I understand it, the end goal is not to produce money for the Treasury, it's to bring manufacturing back, correct?
That's correct, Tommy. That's from what I understand, that's what he's trying to do. And again, I'm a supporter of that. I think manufacturing creates wealth in the United States, so it's a smart approach. However, it's, you know, how do you get there? And that's the issue that we're seeing today.
And it seems to me, while tariffs might be a good idea, you also have to make sure that there's some kind of safeguards in place. Because, for example, this magnet process you're talking about, what, billions in capital investment? And there's no way that a company is going to devote that kind of money unless they know that they're not going to be undercut in the next administration, right? I wouldn't.
You're absolutely.
If I was a business person.
You're absolutely correct, Tommy. I mean, this is the dilemma, right? Is you know, again, if you're a business, you're going to look and say, hey, look, does it make sense for me to invest in the United States? You know, especially if, you know, President Trump's done, and which he will be in 3 years, supposedly. So, you know, that's kind of what everybody's struggling with these days.
So is there any way, what would it take for Congress or whatever to put something in effect long-term where companies would have a guarantee, okay, I'm going to make this billions in capital investment, I'm going to manufacture in the United States, but I need a guarantee that in 2 or 3 years I'm not going to be, again, undercut by foreign countries because these tariffs come off. How would you do that?
Almost impossible to do that, Tommy. So that's the thing. There are no guarantees, right? So again, if you're a business, you know, you're looking at long term from a business standpoint, does this make sense? So, you know, this is again the dilemma, is the United States can try to influence it, but it's like you said, if there's a new administration that comes in, then, you know, they may have an opposite view of what President Trump has as far as tariffs. So, yeah, that could definitely derail anything that you'd want to do, just because, again, from a business standpoint, you want to make money.
And
this would be difficult to do.
And see, I don't know how, other than some kind of legislation or something, I don't know how you could do this, because I just want people to understand this about Trump and tariffs and companies and deciding whether or not to make capital investments. Companies don't look to next week. They look to 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the line, especially when it comes to billions of dollars in capital investment. So they need some kind of security or certainty that they're not going to build, you know, I'll make it simple, an ice cream stand, and then all of a sudden, wait a minute, what do you mean? People can get ice cream imported from China cheaper, now all of a sudden I'm out of business. So if that's the case, I don't know how you can plan on make all of this capital investment and plan on what happens every presidential election. Can you?
You can. And that's the issue. And I think that's, you know, again, we're seeing a lot of companies promise that they're going to invest in the United States, which I think a lot of them will start to do. Mm-hmm. But again, how much and for how long? And that's the issue.
And some of it could be just kind of playing for time.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, again, I can tell you I'm going to invest $100 billion, but how do you know I'm going to do that? And then who follows up? And then, you know, again, who's auditing that whole process?
Do we know what companies have actually decided to relocate here or stop importing stuff and bring the manufacturing back to China, to America?
Yeah, I think some of the steel companies, aluminum companies, there's been talk about that just because the tariffs are so high. Some of the automobile manufacturers are going to be investing more in the United States. But again, we haven't seen that yet, Tommy, so that's the dilemma is, again, when does it happen? How long is it going to take? And then, you know, when President Trump's voted out of office, if he is, then, you know, who replaces him and what's their thoughts and what are they going to do?
We serve 2 terms, so. I don't know. Yeah. We'll see about that. Thanks. Appreciate it, Professor. 6:30. We'll take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Leah Long, the director of Louisiana chapter of the National Federation of Independent Business. We'll talk about tariffs with her and what their concerns are as it relates to that. Right now, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. 6:45, quarter till 7. Tommy Tucker, WWL. We always like to talk about small businesses. And Leah Long joins us, the director of Louisiana chapter, Louisiana Federation of Independent Businesses, to help us do just that. How you doing, Leah?
Good. How are you this morning?
I am okay. Let's talk about this survey that's out about Main Street business owners. Talk about improving conditions.
Yeah, so the latest report shows that the optimism has it's rose up a little bit. And so we're thinking that contributes a lot to that the business owners they have more positive expectations on business conditions and expansion opportunities right now. And that's kind of tied into the 20% small business deduction that was made permanent in the Big Beautiful Bill signed by President Trump. Huge win for small business owners. And so they're counting on that to kind of be able to plan for their future. And I think that's why the optimism has rose.
Tell me about tariffs and how independent businesses feel about tariffs, because I was just talking to a professor of supply chain practice, and what I don't get is how a big company, not a small independent business, but how a big company can make a decision on capital investment when they don't really know what the situation's going to be two or three years from now, and how does that affect small businesses, tariffs when it comes to imports, et cetera?
Yeah, so when we were kind of dealing with all the tariffs, new tariffs back then, we and still now, we didn't really engage our members that much on it because their biggest concern was always the 20% deduction because that was going to affect them more. When it comes to small business, obviously it's, you know, what type of industry you're in, how bad they'll affect you, but their biggest issue has always been that tax deduction. That was their focus. And, you know, another issue that we always constantly hear about in their businesses is the labor quality and the job openings. And so that's kind of where their head is when it comes to the biggest issues right now.
What about employees?
Yeah, so employees, you know, one of their biggest concerns still in the Optimism Report was the labor quality. And, you know, we talk about that here on the show a lot. We got to have a quality work set for to be able to fill these jobs. You know, the ideal goal is, you know, especially with Optimism Rising, is you want to expand your business. Well, you got to have employees for that, and you've got to have the right skill set. So I think, you know, this last year in the legislature, doing the one-door policy really is going to move the needle in the right direction for helping the business community and employment opportunities here in Louisiana.
Not everybody's happy with everything. What are some of the things that small business owners are not particularly happy about
or have
trouble with?
The labor quality is an issue. You know, we did all this reform on insurance. So insurance premiums were, you know, that was one of their biggest issues because they were outrageous, I think, for everyone. So as we see those bills kind of play out and the new legal climate change, we're hoping insurance rates will change. And that'll give some relief to these small business owners because at the end of the day, you got to make that bottom line. And so you either absorb the cost of new things or you have to pass it on to your consumers.
Tell me about startups of new businesses.
Yeah, so I always like to say startups. It's never a good time, you know, I always use the analogy, it's never a good time to have a kid, but you do it anyway. So, you know, sometimes it's not always good to have, you know, start up a business. But if you have a passion and you want to own your own small business, you do it anyways. There's a lot of resources out there to help. You need to, you know, check around, see what your competition will be like where you live and, you know, talk to NFIB, talk to your local small business, SBA, wherever you're located, and kind of see what the opportunity is. But there's no greater thing than to own and operate your own small business.
So it's never too late to start thinking, never too early, rather, start thinking about the next legislative session. What is it that Louisiana lawmakers can do to help small business owners?
You know, we talk about reform in all areas. You know, we did insurance reform. You know, when you talk about health insurance, too, you know, those premiums, the mandated things that you have to cover, it increases that insurance premium for the small business owners. We also need to talk about workers' comp reform. We have some of the highest premiums here in Louisiana, and so that's something that affects a small business. So I'm hoping that we can gain some momentum and maybe in this next 2026 session tackle some of those things.
Hey, let me take a break because I don't want to drill down a little bit on that health insurance thing because it seems like you want qualified workers, but if you want to attract them, an insurance package would be part of that. So we'll talk about that balance when we come back. Leah Long's our guest, director of the Louisiana chapter of the National Federation of Independent Businesses. If you own a small business, I would love to hear from you because I think you are the backbone of America. And I would like to know what you're happy about, what you're not happy about with your small business. 504-260-1870, Oakman Heart Jeweler Talk and Text Line. Please, no texting and driving ever. Right now it's time for traffic on WWL. 6:56, 4 till 7, Tommy Tucker talking to our friend Leah Long, Director of Louisiana Chapter of the National Federation of Independent Businesses. I'm looking at the Small Business Optimism Index components, and I guess when I see current inventory too low, minus 3%, that's as opposed to last season? I don't know how you can get minus 3%.
Yeah, compared to last season, okay. Kind of where they were at this point of the year.
That makes sense. When it comes to job openings, 33%, about a third of businesses, and that brings us to health insurance. Tell me what you were saying before, Leah, about the mandates or health insurance, and because it's a balance, right? Small businesses, they're in competition to gain employees or to get employees, mm-hmm. but they also need to provide benefit packages, but that's expensive. Tell me about that balance.
You know, so every government mandated thing that you need to cover in your health insurance, you know, which we see that a lot in the state legislature every year, you know, we try to fight back against those because obviously it raises the price of the premiums. And,
like,
you know,
like what, for example? I'm trying to understand.
Some of them, it just, It just kind of depends. You know, a lot of some are like cancer treatment. Some, you know, have to do with just different autoimmune diseases, just whatever it may be offers, which, you know, there's a balance in all of that. And so, you know, you try to offer the best plan you can for your employee. And so one of the things I like to say, when you go to hire an employee in a small business, you don't have an HR firm normally. So you've got to invest capital in training that employee. You've got to invest capital in onboarding that employee. It takes time and money to do that. So you want to get a great skilled worker in there, and one, you want to give them a good compensation package, and that does include insurance, health insurance. And so sometimes small businesses can offer it, sometimes they can't. But, you know, obviously as the premiums start increasing, and depending what it is and what the plan is, you have to find the money in your business to pay for that. And so that's why, you know, the bottom line is there. You've got to either be able to give it or absorb the cost or pass it on to consumers. And so that's kind of, each small business has their own decision on that. But, you know, health insurance, I think, is just outrageous in the country anyways right now. And so there's got to be something done so people can afford that, businesses can offer it, and the balance can be there in general.
What would you like to be, what would you like to see the legislature address in the next session?
I would love to see them address, you know, some of these health insurance issues, some workers' comp issues. You know, this last year was a fiscal year, but there really was no tax reform done. So I'm intrigued to see if we continue to keep up with all the other southern states like Mississippi and lower our personal income tax rate. The ideal would be to see eventually eliminate it, but continue to move that in the right direction, because it does benefit these small business owners that are past their entities.
Thank you, Leah. Appreciate your time as always. Director of Louisiana Chapter of the National Federation of Independent Businesses, NFIB. We come back, we're going to talk to Jeff Palermo, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network News Director, about hopefully some football and not legal things as it relates to LSU. Then we'll talk with the Director of Community Engagement for Unity of Greater New Orleans about how the fight against homelessness in the area is going. Lock on up. Stay with us. Tommy Tucker, WWL. LSU countdown and a kickoff with Clemson. Before that, you got Ohio State playing Texas, which is going to be a huge game. Jeff Palermo joins us now, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network News Director. How you doing, Jeff?
I'm doing well, Tommy. How about yourself?
I am okay. Tell me the date of the LSU-Ohio State game. I don't have it in front of me. LSU-Clemson.
LSU-Clemson, and then, yeah, you're right, Ohio State-Texas. Great day of college football to kick it off, August 30th.
But LSU plays first, right?
No, LSU plays at night.
At night. The game is during the day.
Ohio State-Texas game will be the first game of the day.
Well, August 30th is going to be a day for inside watching. I guarantee you that, inside TV watching. Let's talk about LSU. Yesterday, I think we talked about LSU, or the day before, but it was about the legal maneuverings, not anything about actually on the field or on football. Tell me about what's been going on at practice.
Well, I think there's still quite a bit of optimism at this point, Tommy. You know, Nussmeier's look good. You had the injury scare last week that maybe he suffered a significant knee injury, but all it was basically tendonitis. And he's performed well. He's got a great group of wide receivers to throw the football to, two outstanding tight ends and Trey Dez, or at least two outstanding pass-catching tight ends and Trey Dez Green, and then also Bauer Sharp. And, you know, the big question mark, I think the big question mark for the entire team is this offensive line.
Mm-hmm.
You're basically replacing everyone. DJ Chester is moving to another spot on the offensive line from center to guard, but it's not a guarantee that he'll even be a starter against Clemson. Or if he is a starter against Clemson, there's always the possibility he can get beat out as the season goes on.
Did you say moving from D-line to offensive line?
Offensive line, okay. Center to guard, he's moving from.
Oh, all right.
DJ Chester. So it's an entire new offensive line, and LSU's defensive line has looked really good. So is the question, you know, LSU's O-line struggling that bad, or is LSU's defensive line that much better this season? And I'll say defensively for LSU, there's just a lot of depth. I mean, it's a defense that could withstand a few injuries and still, I think, be a good defense. And I think it's got pieces of this defense that Blake Baker can work with a little bit better. You know, last year, you had an injury early on in the season to Jacoby and Guillory, and it just completely messed up the defensive line. You were moving guys from defensive end to defensive tackle. You're playing guys at defensive tackle that had never played defensive tackle, like Ahmad Bro. So it really caused a problem. And then you had the Harold Perkins injury, and you weren't getting anything out of your safeties, and you only had really a two or three cornerbacks that you could play. This year, it's just completely different. It's just a lot of guys. Now the question is, I think on defense for me is, it seems like they got a lot of good players, but do they have great players on defense? I think that to me is the big question, to see if that's the case. I mean, you look at a guy like AJ Halsey, who will likely start at safety. He was a really good player at Houston. He had 5 interceptions last year. He was an all Big 12 player. All right, let's see him now here in the SEC going up against, you know, top flight wide receivers. Let's see how good he will be. I mean, if this guy is a great player and he intercepts 5 passes again, that is just going to help this defense. And then again, we sit here and wait to see if Harold Perkins can really be the playmaker defensively, the game wrecker, the guy that's just going to create havoc out there. The hype, again, is building for Harold Perkins to have a big season. And now we got to wait and see if that's really going to happen.
If I'm the defensive coordinator, I'm taking Harold Perkins by his face mask gently and saying, son, go out and play football. Now go get him. That's all I'm saying.
Well, that's the idea this year. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the idea this year, is you have him as a guy that's going to be rushing the passer, trying to get in the backfield, but then he will drop back in coverage. I mean, he's athletic enough. He can play in space like that enough that he can help you in the passing game, or, you know, cover a tight end. He'll go up against Tre'Davious Green, who's, you know, obviously one of LSU's freak athletes at tight end. And, he'll battle with him during practice. So he's, I think they got him in the right position. I don't think he'd be as, I don't want to say that it's bad, or I think he'll be more noticeable this season, but to what extent, I think that remains to be seen.
One thing is, you talk about defensive backs. One of my startling memories of last year with LSU is another team scoring a touchdown, defensive backs looking at each other with the shrug emoji. Right? What have they done, or how do you think the communication will be this year?
Well, I think it's just I think they're just better at the safety position. Jardon Gilbert was hurt last year. I mean, that was the big acquisition they made in the transfer portal, but he just wasn't himself. Sage Ryan, it just never fit like you thought it was going to fit for him here at LSU. I mean, he was a 4-star, some even thought like 5-star prospect out of Lafayette. And, you know, they move them to cornerback, they move them to safety, they move them to corner. You know, I just think it just didn't work for Sage here. And then, as I mentioned, you were really young at cornerback, especially with Ashton Stamps. And if you go back to the USC game, you saw a lot of true freshman P.J. Woodland in that game, and they just didn't have a lot of guys. They tried J.B. and Toviano, Deshaun Spears, and eventually they kind of just went with 4 or 5 guys that they thought could get it done, but it just – I think they've upgraded the talent. I mentioned A.J. Halsey. Tamarcus Cooley is much better – is a much better fit. Jardon Gilbert's healthy this season. At the cornerback position.
Let me sneak a break in here, Jeff, and we're going to talk about DJ Pickett and Ashton Stamps when we come back, and are they likely to be the two starting corners? Jeff Palermo, our guest, talking LSU football. He's got a piece up about Barry and Brown. We'll talk about that as well. You can find it at WWL.com. 720 traffic, WWL. Why is that guy out on the field? Who let him? Shouldn't there be security? I said get off the field! Again, my Brian Kelly impersonation. Jeff Palermo is our guest, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network News Director. Tell me about starting corners. We got Ashton Stamps, who started last year. We got this freshman, what's his name? DJ Pickett. And then you got this transfer from Virginia Tech, Monsieur Delane. What are we looking like?
Well, this is what I was talking about a little bit in the segment before. I mean, last year it was basically Ashton Stamps, Zy Alexander, and P.J. Woodland. And Woodland was a freshman out there and at times overmatched. And they would throw Sage Ryan out there at cornerback as well. But this year the position is much more stable. I mean, Ashton Stamps is now a junior. This guy is an experienced player for LSU that's played a lot of football. Mansoor Delane was an outstanding cornerback at Virginia Tech, expected to really solidify that position, give him some experience once again. You mentioned, well, before I get to DJ Pickett, Jakeem Jackson, he's been slowed a little bit by an injury, but this was a guy that last year at Florida started the first two games before he suffered a season-ending injury. But
At corner, but
he's very much part of the picture this season. And then DJ Pickett, who is just an absolutely freak athlete at 6'5", 195 pounds. I mean, you just don't see a ton of 6'5" cornerbacks there. And one of the top cornerbacks in coming out of high school. But one of the guys that has made probably had one of the more impressive camps this fall is P.J. Woodland. Again, he took his lumps last year as a freshman, but he's learned a lot from that. He's grown. He has been really, really good this season. So I think you're going to see kind of a rotation there at corner. I think you're going to see mainly, though, at the start, it's going to be Mansoor Delane, Ashton Stamps, and P.J. Woodland. Let's see where Jakeem Jackson is health-wise. You know, yesterday he was riding the bike, so it's not a serious injury, but and so they don't have to thrust DJ Pickett out there right away, but I mean the future is certainly bright for that young man.
You know, I think it also might go to who you're playing, right? Because if you got DJ Pickett that's 6'5", and you got a receiver that's 6'5",
yeah,
then maybe you start him in that game, right?
Well, I think it's just the experience. I just don't think you really want to be playing true freshman cornerbacks, especially early on in the season. I think you want to go with some experienced guys. And Ashton Stamps and Mansoor Delane have played a lot of football. And P.J. Woodland is playing with this confidence that, you know, last year his head was probably spinning as a true freshman. So I think it's just good when you bring in guys like D.J. Pickett, who are big-time recruits. And, yeah, you want to see him get on the field, but you don't have to rush it. Yeah. And I think that's what you got here with D.J. Pickett. You really like the talent. You really like what he can do, but you don't have to throw it out there and throw him out there against Clemson and just hope that he's able to survive. You can ease him into it a little bit.
One thing I don't want to see is or hear is the other team's fight song in the corners, looking at each other, and the safety's like, "What? I thought you was." No, I don't want to see that at all. Thank you, Jeff Palermo. We didn't get to Barry and Brown, but y'all can go to WWL.com.
Yeah.
And read Jeff's article on that. We'll take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the homeless situation in New Orleans. Right now, we pause for WWL First News. So that we go to Ian Ozan. 7:45, quarter till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL. We're going to talk about the homeless situation in New Orleans now with Joe Heron.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
You know, there are a lot of passions. Some days it's sports, other days it's cooking, or music, or just diving into a great documentary. The thing is, whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Amazon Prime isn't just about fast delivery. Though getting stuff the same day is pretty great. But it turns out it's so much more. Prime Video, Amazon Music, the whole range of services. It's like a hub for all kinds of curiosity. Prime helps people stay connected to what matters and keeps the journey of exploration going. Whether it's watching something inspiring, listening to a new artist, or getting gear delivered fast to chase a new hobby, Prime makes it easier to dive in. So yeah, whatever you're into, it's on Prime. From streaming to shopping, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever sparks interest. Amazon.com/Prime.
Game day or any day, your fit says it all. Hit up MLBShop.com for the latest jerseys, caps, hoodies, and accessories to keep you in the game all year long. Rep your team, rep your city, rep yourself. Gear up and game on at MLBShop.com, the official online shop of Major League Baseball. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Hate doing cardio? Try brushing and flossing your teeth. I'm not talking about building up a sweat. I'm talking about building a healthier mouth for a healthier heart for a healthier you. Smile Generation trusted dentists look at your care through the lens of the mouth-body connection, because what happens in the mouth plays a critical role for the rest of your body. To find a dentist near you committed to treating all of you, visit smilegeneration.com/confidence today and live longer, healthier, and happier with Confidence Unleashed.
Mueller, Director of Community Engagement for Unity of Greater New Orleans. How are you, Joe?
Good morning, Tommy. Thank you. Having a good day.
Good. Thanks for taking the time with us. Tell us first about Unity of Greater New Orleans for people that know of it but not about it.
Sure. Yeah, we are a collective of over 50 organizations working together to end homelessness. And our mission is to prevent, reduce, and end homelessness in Orleans and Jefferson Parish, which is the area that we serve. Mm-hmm. And we work to do that by housing people from the streets, from the shelters, people who are veterans, people who are survivors of violence, youth, families. And we work to get them into permanent housing and to provide the supportive services that help them maintain that housing long term.
I'm on the website right now, and I see a page that says how New Orleans reduced its homeless population by 90%. Tell me how they did it.
Well, this is a long-term project that involves coordination of many different agencies, many different organizations, to bring down homelessness, which was once well over 11,000 people post-Katrina, to a much more manageable situation, but still, not okay for the people who are experiencing homelessness. Over a long period of time. And we did that by targeting the people who are most vulnerable for housing, the least able to provide and maintain their housing on their own, by making sure that there are supports to keep them housed as long as possible, and to do advocacy and make sure that there's more affordable housing for more New Orleanians, because as fast as we can house folks when the circumstances of our economy are such that people can't afford the rent, you have problems of more people falling into homelessness. And so we want to make sure that that is not a situation that more people face. We want that to happen for less people rather than more.
So when it comes to misconceptions, I always like to surface them because I want you to deal with them rather than have somebody just driving along or listening wherever they are and believing what they want to believe that may or may not be true. One common, I think, misconception is that people that are homeless want to be there.
We haven't seen that to be the case. In fact, in our experience, when folks are offered a safe, secure, affordable place to live, they take that opportunity, and people are very happy to contribute their income toward their rent share because they want to be housed. People may not want a shelter. Not everybody who's unsheltered may want to go into a shelter, but we don't see people who refuse housing. Just for example, back in 2020 and 2021, we were able to reduce unsheltered homelessness to historically low numbers, as low as, I think, below 40, maybe as low as 35, in New Orleans because we had a program to get folks into hotels and then to navigate them from there into shelter. People accepted that because they wanted shelter in hotels. They wanted a place where they could close the door and have that security of having their own home. And so we know that that's something that almost everybody wants.
I would caution people against ever using never or everybody, because it's never, it doesn't apply, nor does everybody, because there are exceptions to every rule. Somebody texted in here, and we got a break coming up, so maybe we'll wait until after so you can have some uninterrupted time. They texted in and they said, Tommy, can you please ask your guest coming up, how can local people help the homeless? Please don't say donate. We're done with that. Called for help. So much red tape to help individuals. We feed homeless now, shelter some ourselves, call different organizations, and all we got, ID, medical records, just so much requests. These are homeless people that have nothing to even say. Tell them to go online to different websites, really. Any answers would be helpful. That's a kind of long, rambling text, probably voice to text, and I've been there myself. But you can address the major issues there when we come back. We're talking to Joe Heron Mueller, Director of Community Engagement for Unity of Greater New Orleans, about the fight against homelessness in the New Orleans and Jefferson Parish areas. 7:50, 10 till 8. That's time for traffic on WWL. 7:55, about 4 minutes left with our guest from Unity of Greater New Orleans, Joe Heron Mueller, Joe, Director of Community Engagement for Unity of Greater New Orleans. I'm seeing a letter here at Unity of Greater New Orleans. Unity found Roosevelt Mills, 55, cancer patient, loss of kidney and part of his lung, steel rod implanted in his leg to replace deteriorating bone, living in a cage-like box. And y'all were able to get him into his own small apartment. The texter texted in that they were fed up with giving, for whatever that means, or donating money. But Unity New Orleans is wide open about its books, and unless you talk about one specific individual, it seems like that's kind of the best way to help with the homeless situation. Thoughts?
Yeah, well, you know, financial donations are always appreciated, but there are other ways that people in the community contribute. I mean, obviously, in your own community, you know, people need, you know, those materials to just get through the day. And if that's something that people feel comfortable doing, then that's something.
But
that
let me jump in here.
Go ahead.
Well, yeah. Because this person texted back and said, I fed a homeless person in my backyard, comes every morning. He said he's a veteran from Vietnam, no ID, no discharge papers. So we asked before, anyway, all he has is a bicycle. How can I call to get him a place to stay? This is one specific case study, I guess, Joe. What do they do?
Well, that's a great question. So in that situation, we would ask that they send him to our information and referral line, because we have prided ourselves on reaching out, and particularly to vets and getting veterans housed.
Can this person do it for them if this vet has no access to any information line or anything?
They could call for the vet. You know, our service providers, which include the VA, uh-huh, are not going to provide people. You know, they're not going to speak on about a person's situation without a waiver of information. But they can certainly get that information, direct them to a shelter, and the number for that information and referral service is 504-658-2944.
So this person that's dealing with the Vietnam veteran, the homeless Vietnam veteran with no discharge papers, they could call that number and get the process started?
They could. They could get the process started. They would help direct that veteran to the VA, who could get his paperwork in order and get him on the path to housing.
But it's not as easy as calling and saying, hey, I got a homeless guy that I'm feeding, and you send somebody out there. It's not that simple.
It's not quite that simple, no. We'd have to get in touch with him, verify his homelessness and his veteran status in this case, and get him on the path. But we are able to house veterans within an average of 30 days, and we've been doing that for the last 10 years.
And to be fair, you know, people call it red tape, but there are a lot of federal grants involved here, a lot of public money, and you got to be responsible for that, and you're under intense scrutiny. That's why there are policies and procedures that you have to follow, correct?
Absolutely. And if I can add, Tommy, yeah. if
if there are folks who would like to find have other ways and they don't have money to contribute or they don't know somebody personally who's going through this, but they want to get involved, they can donate household goods and furniture. As we move people into housing, we are always on the lookout for the materials that can help smooth that transition, whether that be a plate, a bowl, a pot, a sofa, a chair. Those are things that can really help folks. And we do pick up furniture items across Orleans and Jefferson Parishes.
UnityGNO.org. That's where you go to get directed from there. Thank you for what you're doing, Joe Heeren-Mueller, Director of Community Engagement for Unity of Greater New Orleans. We'll be back. WWL. Text comes in, says that Dr. Cromartie is retired from UNO. Well, congratulations. Thank you. Thank you for the education you gave me. Ronald Serpas joins us now, you can be director if you want. You can be whatever the hell you want to be. Professor of Practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD superintendent, head of the Washington State Police, Nashville City Police. How you doing? Stretch?
Tommy, I'm wonderful.
I'm going to call you Stretch because you're like 7 feet eight. How tall are you? Can you dunk a basketball? Have you ever tried or not?
Perhaps as a youngster, but not anymore, I can tell you.
Did you ever? Could you ever or not? It was just sheer
close.
Speculation.
Just pure speculation. I was at Abramson High School before I dropped out of high school. Mm-hmm. I played on the basketball team, and I might have been one of the few that were close, but there were a couple who were good.
So I did it one time, and that was, you know, when the kid had the little bitty basketball goal. It was like 2 feet high. All right, let's talk about...
I'll do a shot out of a cannon.
No. But that would be fun. That'd be a good stunt, wouldn't it?
I think it'd be great.
Let's talk about... I want to start with Washington, D.C., if I can. I want to leave mm-hmm. President Trump mm-hmm. out of this. I don't, because he's such mm-hmm. a lightning rod. I want to make it President Zanzibar, okay? President Zanzibar decides to send the National Guard and the FBI on the streets of Washington to take, quote, the Capitol back to deal with the homeless situation. I know I was in Washington earlier this year. Now, granted, it was cold, so I don't know if that makes a difference or not. But I walked around for 6 hours during the day, 4 hours at night, never felt unsafe. And I mean, I walked up and down the city from all over, from the Capitol to the Lincoln Memorial, White House, Ellipsis, Georgetown, you name it. I was walking there. Thoughts on just the use of the FBI doing that, et cetera?
So one of the things about D.C. is it's like New Orleans in this way. The French Quarter and the CBD and the Garden District, for example, are not the same as the Ninth Ward, the Seventh Ward. They're not the same as Little Woods. It's not the same as Michoud. It's not the same as Central City, et cetera. So what happens is we see D.C. often in the same way we see New Orleans as the center of that experience. But where D.C. is suffering with these tremendous young men shooting and killing each other and robbing people and young groups of teenagers roaming the streets all hours of the day and night is generally not going to be in the downtown tourist area because mm-hmm. there is a lot of visible police. There are a lot of visible federal police agencies, like, you know, the ATF has a uniformed police force,
you know what?
That roams around their exterior buildings.
Let me tell you this, and in all fairness, let me tell you this. When I was there, it was like a week before the inauguration, so things were tighter than Crab's rear end. Okay, I just realized that, so I'm glad you said that. Go ahead.
Well, and one of the things, and, you know, several people have talked about it, and I've said it with you several times, the government counts crime.
Mm-hmm.
Half of all crime goes unreported in the country. We know that to be true. I even sent you the citation last week, so you knew I wasn't just making this stuff up.
Right.
And third, most importantly, Pew Research does this all the time. Americans understand crime from what their friends, neighbors, and relatives tell them. They're not interested in what the news media says, God bless their souls. They're not interested in what the mayor says or the police chief says.
Mm-hmm.
So when we see politicians use crime as if it's almost a mysterious, mythical words out of the oldest text ever written to say, you thou shall for feel safe, is absolutely not how people feel in the real world. So D.C. has a terrible murder rate, and it gets better this year. It's still a terrible murder rate. It would be the fourth worst in the country if they had the reductions they expect this year. And I said this with somebody yesterday, and I really wanted to share it with your audience this morning. In 1994, Richard Pennington, my mentor, my friend, was hired from D.C. because D.C. had a worse crime problem than New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted an experienced crime fighter, Mayor Morial, in Pennington. So the fact that D.C.'s had this crime problem didn't just occur yesterday.
So when it comes to the most efficacious way of using law enforcement personnel, National Guard and FBI, is that the best? Are those the best assets? Or given what the FBI does, could they be better used fighting terrorism, et cetera, et cetera? I don't know. I'm asking you.
I think it's a combination of things. I mean, first off, the president is using President Zanzibar is using a specific statute that has nothing to do with the Insurrection Act, as I understand it. So therefore, the federal government and the District of Columbia have had a special relationship for almost 250 years. This is a 30-day, perhaps 30-day rotations of doing so. I think part of it may be just guessing. We were told for 4 years that we couldn't fix the border, we couldn't stop intrusions at the border unless we had new statutes. A new guy came in and says, I stopped it. We just needed a new guy. So it's the shaking of the conscience of the norm. So perhaps, and I'm not advocating for either side, perhaps what the President Zanzibar is doing is saying, if we come in and in 30 days make people in Antioch feel better, maybe y'all should be thinking differently about the way you do your job. Now, I've got a lot of experience in the D.C. Police Department professionally as a consultant, and I'm bound by some of those privacies. But let me tell you something. They've got serious issues that they have to confront with management practices, that they have to confront with a city council that appears to me to be totally detached from reality as it relates to juvenile crime, as it relates to repeat offenders. And Tommy, you can take this to the bank. Sociologists will say this. I'll say this from experience. In any city in America, about 3 to 5% of the population is likely to be repeat violent offenders. In the United States of America, Tommy, hold on now. You might want to hold your chair. In the United States of America, the total population, less than 1% of that total population of this country is incarcerated. What more evidence do we need to know that this is a small number of people causing havoc on a larger number of people? So maybe not unlike you saw when they hired me to come back here, they hired me to go to Nashville, or they hired Pennington to go to Washington, or they hired Chuck Ramsey to go to Washington. It's sometimes it's just you want to break up the status quo and say, maybe there's another way of thinking about this. Maybe that's what's going on.
I don't want you to violate any confidences, but if you were the head of the Washington, D.C. police force, how would you accept this or how would you take this?
Well, I would probably say, look, I'll use all the help I can to make people who live in this city feel safer. So what do you have that I don't have? And let's figure out how to apply it. I don't think it ever looks good to look a gift horse in the mouth, right? I was a chief for a long time with a lot of people wanting to help. In fact, you might have heard me say this before. When I came back in 2010, we were being investigated by so many people because of the Katrina era. There was a Boy Scout troop in Shreveport that had a merit badge for investigating the New Orleans Police Department. I didn't refuse anybody's assistance.
Right.
I never said no to a single person. If you could help us make New Orleans feel safe, let's do it.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Ronald Surpass, 823 Traffic, WWL. 827, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Ronald Surpass, former NOPD superintendent, consultant all over the country, head of the Nashville State Police, formerly in the Washington State Police. Chief, one thing I wanted to address with you, and I wanted to pay honor to before we let you go, is Baton Rouge Police Sergeant Caleb Eisworth, 23-year veteran of the department, some idiot, apparently with a deep hatred for law enforcement, I'm going to say allegedly, drove his truck into and purposely hit this officer while he was on his motorcycle just going home. And that was 2 months ago. He died. He's now facing first-degree murder charges, the suspect is, with the death penalty. What effect does that have on the morale of a department when you lose somebody that's a member of the family?
Oh, it's devastating, and it's also devastating on the community because when someone purposely attacks a police officer, it's often been said, and I believe it to be true, that's an attack on society at large because the police are the most obvious representation of the social contract we all have to follow the laws, to follow the morals. It's a young man, children, family, grandchildren that won't be knowing their grandfather. I mean, it's just horrific, and every death of a police officer is very painful for the men and women who do the job. And I also think about this, Tommy. Both of my daughters are married to police officers, and I'm incredibly proud of them. My mother was a mother of a police officer and the wife of a police officer. And imagine what those family members go through. And it's not make-believe to say. They may very well often say, you know, so-and-so is going to work today. I wonder if I'll see him tonight.
Right.
That's, you know, that's the kind of people that are disparaged by so many on the far, far left who they don't call drug dealers when they need help. They call the police. And thank God we have men and women who are willing to do this work.
How does somebody, what does sociology show you? Or how does somebody develop such a deep hatred for law enforcement that they're going to murder somebody on a motorcycle just going home?
You know, that's more of a psychologist question, right? I mean, how can you murder anybody for any reason? And a police officer, in doing so, you do it in a way that represents disdain for the social contract, the agreement that we all have to follow the rules. And when we know we won't follow the rules, we agree to empower people to enforce the rules for us. That's as basic as this society is. And to strike out against that, I think, does exactly what we said. It speaks more to just an internal psychological disagreement. It's a swipe at the culture at large. It's a swipe at the community at large. And that's why you see legislatures throughout the country usually have the most significant penalties on a conviction. Everybody's innocent until proven guilty because of those kind of concepts in the background.
Yeah, I always thought that if you're going to kill a police officer, then you would kill. If somebody's going to kill a police officer, they would kill me in a heartbeat. They wouldn't even think twice about that. Thank you, Chief. I appreciate your time. I'm sure if you search Caleb Eisworth, C-A-L-E-B-E-I-S-W-O-R-T-H, you'll find ways to contribute to help his family, because he does leave behind a 12-year-old daughter, grandkids, etc. Right now we pause for WWO First News. 8:46, 14 till 9. Man, I love to talk about businesses, ideas that were started in New Orleans and expand all over the country. And with that, we welcome in Ethan Cheremy, founder and CEO of On Scene Services. How you doing, Ethan?
Great, Tommy. Great. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for coming on. I went to oss.cityemployment. Well, I Googled, actually, On Scene Services, and it says you can apply in New Orleans or Baltimore. Are those the two cities you're in, or is that just the only two cities that you need people in?
Those are the two we need people in, but we're currently also hiring for the new city of St. George, which is the portion that recently formed from South Baton Rouge around Seguin Lane, okay. Highland, Bluebonnet area.
All right. Let's talk about what it is that you all do. Where did the idea come from?
Oh, geez. A long time in the making. Even consulted back with Chief Harrison on this in 2017. And we put the first cars on the road in New Orleans in late 2018. And it just goes back to the theory of a police officer with arrest powers and a firearm. What's the best use of that limited resource that we have as a society? Is it deploying him to go and do paperwork in the middle of the street for a crash? Or is it to have him chase the quote-unquote bad guy that may have just committed some kind of violent act instead? And it seems like we can use our commissioned police officers for those higher priority violent type of calls instead of these lower priority or lower civil matters like traffic accidents.
The reason we wanted to have you on is, you know, crime is...
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
You know, there are a lot of passions. Some days it's sports, other days it's cooking, or music, or just diving into a great documentary. The thing is, whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Amazon Prime isn't just about fast delivery. Though getting stuff the same day is pretty great. But it turns out it's so much more. Prime Video, Amazon Music, the whole range of services. It's like a hub for all kinds of curiosity. Prime helps people stay connected to what matters and keeps the journey of exploration going. Whether it's watching something inspiring, listening to a new artist, or getting gear delivered fast to chase a new hobby, Prime makes it easier to dive in. So yeah, whatever you're into, it's on Prime. From streaming to shopping, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever sparks interest. Amazon.com/Prime.
Game day or any day, your fit says it all. Hit up MLBShop.com for the latest jerseys, caps, hoodies, and accessories to keep you in the game all year long. Rep your team, rep your city, rep yourself. Gear up and game on at MLBShop.com, the official online shop of Major League Baseball. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Hate doing cardio? Try brushing and flossing your teeth. I'm not talking about building up a sweat. I'm talking about building a healthier mouth for a healthier heart, for a healthier you. Smile Generation. Trusted dentists look at your care through the lens of the mouth-body connection, because what happens in the mouth plays a critical role for the rest of your body. To find a dentist near you, committed to treating all of you, visit smilegeneration.com/confidence today and live longer, healthier, and happier with Confidence Unleashed.
Down, but the NOPD still is not at full manpower. Whatever full manpower happens to be, Chief Surpass will say we don't. He's not sure what the right number is, but I gotta believe that you guys got to take a little bit of credit for that in freeing up officers, right?
I'd like to think so. We don't necessarily brag on it, but we did have a third party do an independent report, EJM Consultants, which basically found that in the year 2024, last year, we responded to right at 10,000 calls, 10,000 traffic calls on behalf of NOPD. And that had the equivalent of about 24,000 man hours, officer hours, that NOPD was available able to use to redeploy to a higher type priority call. And that's ultimately the equivalent of just about 16 or 17 full-time officers.
Say that again, because I think that is amazing.
Right? 24,000 man hours, officer hours, were available to put back in the queue. That's 24,000 hours that NOPD did not have to spend responding to traffic calls. They can respond to other types of calls instead. And that was the equivalent of about 16 to 17 full-time officers.
Let me ask you about the public's response to this and your response time. First of all, how long does it take you guys to get out to an accident? I know you're hiring. How understaffed are you? And what's the public's response been? And I'll ask the audience right now, as a matter of fact, to text me on the Oakland Jeweler Talking text line, 504-260-1870, if you've gotten into an accident. And I got to tell you, I got a new truck. Ethan, with all that, the alarms and everything else that go off, if you get in an accident, shame on you. I don't know how you can. You got to not be paying attention at all. But if you have dealt with OSS, tell me about it at 504-260-1870. No texting and driving, or you will be dealing with OSS. But anyway, tell me about how the public's responded and insurance companies, et cetera. Nothing changed, right? Nothing's different with OSS handling an accident.
Correct. Lots to unpack there. And sure, is it a perfect model yet? No, absolutely. There's still some gaps that need to be tightened up here and there. But we provide total daily transparency to NOPD. They know where all of our response units are at any given time. We have full performance dashboards for them and to review. And we have monthly meetings with NOPD leadership to show our impact overall. And everything remains the same for a motorist out there. If you get in a crash, you still call 911. OPCD, the big dispatch, 911 dispatch, will dispatch an OSS agent, if he is available, to respond to that call. We're there in under 15 minutes, and we have the parties released normally within about 35 minutes after being on scene.
Tell me about the process. People call the accident in to the police, and then it gets referred to you. And at which accidents can you guys handle and which can you not?
Correct. People still call 911, and it's really up to OPCD, the dispatch system, on what calls they're going to send us on. This program started with responding only to non-injury accidents. That is the majority of the calls that come into 911 on a daily and annual basis. However, we do cover hit and runs. We'll cover some accidents with injuries. We are in constant communication with NOPD, and if their interdiction or assistance is needed on some calls, we can obviously bring them in on that. And then we also provide supplemental services. So if there's a fatality or so and the interstate needs to be closed, OSS agents and response units may assist in closing those on-ramps, things like that as well. So the service has been working really, really well. We had a measured independent third party, like we said, and we had a great impact in 2024, and we're on pace to do the same thing this year.
Tell me the response time again.
Right at under 15 minutes from the time we're dispatched by 911 to the time we get to a scene.
What was it under NOPD?
Oh, gosh. Those numbers ranged across the board, and you'll still see some outliers like that. For instance, if there's no OSS unit available and there's a call holding that NOPD cannot get to, they may give us that call after it's been holding for a half hour or 45 minutes, an hour or something like that. So it really comes down to staffing during the right times of day, days of the week, et cetera. Friday's the busiest day. You can expect travel time in the afternoon. 4 p.m. is normally the busiest hour throughout the week. So the crash patterns do follow somewhat your assumptions on drive time and when traffic gets heavier.
Ethan, let me get you this text, and it says the problem is they don't give out tickets. Tickets are very crucial in dealing with insurance companies. Are they really or not?
They are not, right? What parties need and what insurance companies are looking for is a neutral third party that basically documents everything that happens and then gives an indication of fault. So in each report, OSS agents will do all of that. We have body cams. We now have body cam video. We have 360 photos of every vehicle involved. We complete that entire crash report, and then we forward it on to NOPD. And NOPD still reviews and touches every crash report. They sign off on it, and then it's submitted to the state in that order. On those reports, we give an indication of fault, which is all your insurance companies are really looking for, is to say, okay, who caused the damage here? So in the narratives, in that story box on a crash report, we will say it is the opinion of the OSS agent that driver number one may be at fault for blank. And then NOPD either agrees with it or they can reject that report and have it sent back to us for amendments and so on, and it works.
Last time I got in an accident in New Orleans Parish was on Camp Street about 5 years ago. Somebody rear-ended me at 5 o'clock, about quarter to 5 in the morning. I sat there waiting for NOPD until I'd say maybe 8:30 when I called Dave Cohen and said, I'm just going to come into work. And we said, screw this, and just exchanged information. So I think it's working. Thank you, Ethan. Appreciate it. Ethan Sheremy, the founder and CEO of the Scene Services, CEO of On Scene Services. You want to apply for a job, go to OSS.com. Right now it's time for traffic on WWL. Back in the day when he actually cared about what they put on TV, I was a mere toddler, but they had the ABC Movie of the Week, which aired on Tuesday, and they had some pretty good movies on it. Things that were made were Tribes, which was about a guy that joined the Marine Corps. Another one that was critically acclaimed was Duel, which was Steven Spielberg's first film about a guy that gets an 18, Dennis Weaver gets an 18-wheel driver mad. And it continues to follow him, and he just won't forgive him and tries to run him off the road and everything else. What's so scary about that is that the window is blacked out, so you don't even see a person in there. So it's like this ghost truck that's driving around, right? Well, I'm telling you, it's not a bad – if you look at the list of movies from ABC Movie of the Week on Tuesday nights, especially that Tribes, it's pretty good. You'd be surprised. There was some quality movies, some quality television. But I mention that because we're getting ready to talk about autonomous trucks, which in a way is kind of like Duel without the bad part of it, I hope. We're joined now by Steve Viselli, a sociologist at the University of Pennsylvania and author of The Big Rig, Trucking, and the Decline of the American Dream. How you doing, Steve?
Good morning, guys. I'm doing well.
I guess I should call you Professor, not Steve, but it just, when we're talking about trucking, it just seems like a first name kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, Steve is great. Thank you.
Let's talk about autonomous trucks and how they work and how popular they are. I'm looking at a news story here from the New York Times, and they talk about a semi-truck going down a five-lane Texas highway, and nobody's in the, behind the driver's seat. There's somebody in the back seat, a trucker that's watching stuff on YouTube or whatever it is. Is that safe?
Well, they're here now, and they're real, and I think that at least where they are right now, they're operating safely. You know, we're still in a very early phase, mm-hmm. and we're going to see these things all over the place in bigger numbers, and then you know, with cars interacting with them and different, you know, traffic patterns, et cetera. And so they've got to prove themselves in the real world.
Has it caused a lot of displacement in the industry, or has it just filled the void that people were not willing to fill?
Not yet. You know, the challenge with trucking is that a lot of these guys are on the road for a long time and away from home, and that can make it a really tough job to keep people in, especially at some of the lower wage, you know, positions that we see in some of these entry level companies. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's hard to keep people in them, and a lot of these companies would love to get rid of that labor cost. As yet, you know, we haven't seen any displacement because there are only a few of them. And, you know, I do think we've got to think about these folks who do need these jobs, especially if they're in a rural area or something like that and there aren't great jobs around. We've got to be concerned about whether or not, you know, these important jobs for those communities are going away.
What got me about this story is the back seat. I don't understand why the guy would sit in the back seat. It's like you can't it can't hurt to be behind a driver's wheel, can it? I mean, even from him, for his standpoint.
Yeah, well, so Aurora, which is the company that is actually operating these trucks without anybody in the driver's seat, right now they're doing it between Dallas and Houston. They're also working on a lane between Dallas and El Paso that should be doing the same thing very soon. They did pull all people, everyone out of the cab for a little while, and then one of their manufacturers, PACCAR, that was making some of the components, asked them to put someone back in the truck just as an observer. Though my understanding from talking to Aurora about it is that they don't have any role in intervening or anything like that. The truck, if it got into trouble, will pull itself over mm-hmm. to the side of the road and await, remote assistance.
You know, back in the day, I quit college because who needs all of that, right, Professor? And I attended the University of Life for about 10 years, and then I went back and got my degree, but part of which included a stint at Firestone Tires. And we would get a call every week. There's Ivan Cross, the Firestone Tire and Rubber Company, on the way. And we'd get the tires in every week, but it was up to us to unload the truck. He'd go back there and roll them to us, and we had to stack them and all that stuff. And the only reason I say that, does the driver typically unload the truck, or does he just drop it off? And with autonomous trucks, what happens when they get to wherever it is they are? Is that when the driver goes from the back seat to the front seat?
Yeah, there are different ideas about how this is going to work when it's really widespread. Right now, most drivers aren't unloading because so much stuff is palletized. You know, mm-hmm. so it's usually a forklift from from the dock that's unloading it. But we, you know, there are going to be some tasks like obviously fueling the truck, opening the doors up before it backs in, things like that. Some of which could be obviously handled by the customer, but some of which is going to happen out in the middle of the road. So you mentioned tires, you know, common for tractor trailers, obviously, to lose a tire. Mm-hmm. When you're out in that many miles, it's going to happen. And so that truck's got to be able to pull itself over, identify that it's got a flat tire, right? Pull itself over safely to the side of the road. And, you know, those are things that the developers are anticipating. But again, we're going to need a system out there that adapts to, you know, when we have tens of thousands, maybe even 100,000 plus of these machines out there on our public roadways.
People that listen regularly know that one of my favorite phrases is everybody has a story, and you have to, because how does a sociologist at the University of Pennsylvania write The Big Rig, Trucking and the Decline of the American Dream? Take me on that journey, if you would.
Well, it started out because my dad worked at a factory. All the men in my family worked at the same copper and brass factory in upstate New York. And my dad used to weigh the trucks as they came in and out of the factory.
Okay.
So as a kid, I was always around them. And, you know, these long haul drivers would come in and they always had a yarn they would spin. And, you know, so I became interested in the industry generally. And then I learned about deregulation, which happened in 1980 and really put a hurting on trucker wages.
Tell me how that happened there. Was that union or what?
Well, so this was the Carter administration, actually. They started with airlines, they deregulated airlines, and then they deregulated trucking. And part of it was to address the stagflation that was happening at the time, that combination. Yep, a slow economy with inflation, and they wanted to bring down the cost of transportation, of getting goods to people. And so deregulation was a way to make the industry more efficient by removing the federal licenses that were required to move products to and from certain locations. But what ended up happening was, you know, a lot of the cost came on the backs of the drivers. So trucks used to run between these regular locations where they were permitted to go by the federal government. Mm-hmm. Now they started going all over the place. And what I was talking about earlier with those, you know, jobs that are tough to keep people in, that's when that pattern really developed of sending drivers out on the road for weeks at a time, because it turned out that was the most efficient way, at least as far as the freight moved, to move the truck around. So if you had a load going from Syracuse to Michigan, you'd go there, and then maybe there was a load from Michigan down to Mobile, and then Mobile up to Columbus, Ohio. And you'd just follow the freight around. And so that was, you know, saved you on empty miles going back and forth without freight, but meant that the drivers had to live out of the truck. And what happened was, you know, there was a lot of, and there still is today, unfortunately, a lot of unpaid time, time you're spending while someone else is unloading the truck, time when you're out just, you know, parked because you have to take a mandatory safety break. And that's really contributed to a lot of this turnover and churn in the industry that sometimes gets characterized as a shortage. But trust me, we got plenty of people that would love to have a good paying trucking job when they're where they're home every night. Unfortunately, we don't have enough of those kind of jobs.
I'm going to try not to hurt myself here because I struggle with this word, but my late brother was tangential. Say it for me.
Tangentially?
Yeah, tangentially? Say it again.
It's a tough one.
Say it
tangentially.
Again. Tangentially. Yeah, anyway, involved with the trucking industry, and I realized about hours and how they had to keep these log books and the weight and what they had to go through. I don't think the average person realizes that. They think that they just... I don't know. They think that people just get in a truck and then you drive and you pull over at these weigh stations and they weigh you and then they smile and wave on your way. But it's not that easy, is it?
No, it's a tough job. And I'll tell you what, you know, we're around them all day long and they're moving everything that we need. And it's hard work. You know, give these guys a little bit of room and some, you know, some grace, because that thing, it's 80,000 pounds when it's loaded. And when you know, people, especially since COVID, mm-hmm. seeing a lot of aggressive driving.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody's probably noticed it, you know? And when you're in that big truck, you really hope nobody gets in front of you and puts the brakes on, because you just can't stop as quickly as you can in a passenger car. But these guys, you know, they're out there again for weeks at a time. You know, it's a 24-hour-a-day job, and they're working their butts off to make sure we have everything we need.
Jordan, our producer, sent me this phonetically, tangentially. Is that right?
Tangentially.
Yeah, I'm just
sounds
gonna,
good to me.
I'm going to avoid the word completely, Professor. I think I'm just going to put that on. I'm going to put that like on the list of the 7 words you can't say. I'm going to add that to my list of words you can't say on the radio. Hey, with this federal license thing, take me through, if you can, an example, a case study of what it was like before one product, one company, one line, whatever, and what it was like after deregulation, how it changed.
Yeah, so. I mean, the way I like to explain it is kind of how you would imagine UPS works.
Okay.
So when you had licenses, let's say you were moving furniture between North Carolina and Chicago, that would be the authority that you have, as they call them, the federal license. And you went to the Interstate Commerce Commission and you told them, hey, you know, it's going to cost me $1 a mile to run furniture from North Carolina to Chicago. The ICC would tell you, okay, then you can charge $1.06 a mile. And then you had to publish that rate, and you had to charge it, whether it was Walmart shipping that furniture or a mom and pop furniture shop. Everybody got the same rate. And so what you would do, because that was all you could move, is you'd collect all that furniture around, you know, small shipments, big shipments. You'd bring it to your terminal in North Carolina, and you'd combine it into one big full trailer. Mm-hmm. And then you'd send that with a separate driver. So you'd have a local driver and then that would pick it up. And then you'd have a long haul driver that would bring it out to Chicago. And you probably had a matching authority to bring something back from Chicago to North Carolina. And, mm-hmm. and that driver would pick up a trailer of that stuff and bring it back. But then when it got to Chicago, you'd have that third driver who would, you know, do the local deliveries. And so what that meant for drivers was that, you know, you had those three jobs, two of which were local, mm-hmm. and one of which went back and forth between those two locations. So the driver might be out for a day or two, but not for weeks at a time in a random pattern.
So after deregulation, furniture moving would be what? The same case of furniture moving would look like what?
Well, so now the companies would be able to move anything anywhere, essentially, as long as it could go in your trailer. So when I wrote my book, as I was preparing for it, I went out and got a job, you know, sort of undercover for 6 months with a company, sort of seeing what the job was like. I might pick up beer in Syracuse. I'd bring it up to Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, I might pick up steel and bring it down to Houston. In Houston, I might pick up auto glass or Gatorade or whatever it was and bring it out to Ohio. And I would just continue that pattern, just sort of randomly moving around, generally the eastern half of the United States for me, for a couple weeks. And then they'd say, oh, time to get you home. And I would wait for a load that was going, you know, back toward New York, which was where I parked the truck when I was home. And, you know, within a day or two of when I was supposed to get home, they'd find a load that made sense to sort of, you know, assign me. You know, and whatever hours it took to, you know, if the customer was opening at 9 a.m. and could take me, then I'd go then. If it was 4 in the afternoon, it'd be 4 in the afternoon. And you just, you know, you basically plan your day around what the needs of that freight is.
Look at you, Professor University of Life. You're like me. You want to get the real world experience. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. I want to talk about backhauling. I know they've had a problem with that. And real quick, before we do go to the break, this furniture thing with the deregulation, has that led to the problems in the furniture industry where people find their furniture being held hostage because the price they're asked to pay is different than what was quoted?
That certainly can be a part of it, yep.
All right, we'll take a break. Come back. Tommy Tucker, WWL. 9:29. I could spend 3 hours talking to this guy or more. Steve Viselli, a sociologist at the University of Pennsylvania, author of The Big Rig, Trucking and the Decline of the American Dream. For the most part, talking about autonomous trucks, but trucking in general. Somebody texted in and said, interesting saying deregulation when it comes to trucking, since the trucking industry is one of the most regulated in the country, is it? And was it overregulated before?
Yeah, that's a great comment. From your listener there. So the industry was deregulated in economic terms, but then what happened was, you know, because of the competitive pressures that were unleashed there and the, you know, the challenges that it posed for drivers, like I was talking about before with the hours and the days on the road, we ended up having to re-regulate in all sorts of other ways, primarily around safety. And so if you talk to the average trucker today, I mean, they're carrying around a 700-page book that tells them all the rules and regs around what they can and can't do. The big ones that affect them have to do with those hours of service, it's called, which is what, you know, basically when you can drive and for how long. And so drivers are constantly trying to figure out how to meet the needs of their customers while fitting within these rules. Now, your listeners, I'm sure, see these trucks on the side of the road on I-10, I-20 all the time on exits and rest areas trying to sneak into a parking spot. A lot of that is because now they're all on the same clocks for these hours of service rules, and they've got to stop driving at a certain point. They can drive 11 hours during the day over a 14-hour period, and so they're all sort of, you know, fighting for parking spaces, and we just don't have enough of them. So these regulations are really, like, you know, every day, every hour, they're thinking about, you know, what these rules are.
11 hours of driving is a lot.
It is.
So
now they don't
go ahead.
They don't get to average that much. That's the maximum that they're able to drive in one period without taking a break. The average truck, unfortunately, for these long haul drivers is only operating, believe it or not, about 6.5 or 7 hours a day. And that's because of that 14-hour window that they have in which they have to get all of their work done. And so they may spend 3 or 4 hours, typically unpaid, getting loaded at a shipper's location, then drive for 6 hours, and then spend another 3 or 4 hours unpaid getting unloaded. That would be a short load. But, so they end up spending a lot of that work time. When they're only paid for the driving, they spend a lot of that work time not driving, waiting for the customer.
You're not making it sound very attractive, but you're telling the truth. Is that self-reporting on the hours of service, or is that tracked somehow?
So the driving time is recorded automatically by the truck. But
yeah, I guess that was a dumb question, because if you're the only driver, they can tell if the truck's moving or not, right, if it's not autonomous?
Yeah, the truck will record the driving hours, and then it's up to the driver to record the non-driving hours that they work. And typically, they don't record, a lot of those, because they're not paid for them.
Real quick, before we let you go, and I hope you come back, because I think it's a very interesting conversation. And how vital is the trucking industry to distribution and supply chain in the United States?
Well, it's absolutely critical. They're bringing us everything, and they're doing it as we learned during the COVID shutdowns. They're doing it with a pretty tight supply chain. So, this stuff has to move within a day or two. Most products should be moving. We're not storing stuff up in warehouses. And this is just to wrap up on the autonomous trucks. This is where we really need to think about what these, what this technology is going to mean, because that supply system that's bringing us everything, within a couple of days, that's built around the limitations of a human driver. So these guys who are getting in 6.5, 7 hours a day, when we replace them with a machine that's going to be able to drive, 14, even 20 hours a day if it was loaded efficiently, that's going to change where you build all those distribution points. So you might have warehousing up in Baton Rouge that's, supplying New Orleans. It might not have to be there anymore because the trucks can move further and faster. So that whole geography of freight is going to change, and it's going to affect the warehouse workers, where the stores and distribution points are, et cetera.
I hope you come back. Thank you, sir. The book is The Big Rig, Trucking and the Decline of the American Dream. Steve Viselli, sociologist at the University of Pennsylvania. Very interesting conversation. We'll take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Kate Ashford, an investing specialist at NerdWallet, about Americans in a 3-month emergency fund. A lot of Americans don't have them. 9:35 traffic now, WWL.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
There are a lot of passions. Some days it's sports, other days it's cooking or music, or just diving into a great documentary. The thing is, whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Amazon Prime isn't just about fast delivery. Though getting stuff the same day is pretty great. But it turns out it's so much more. Prime Video, Amazon Music, the whole range of services. It's like a hub for all kinds of curiosity. Prime helps people stay connected to what matters and keeps the journey of exploration going, whether it's watching something inspiring, listening to a new artist, or getting gear delivered fast to chase a new hobby. Prime makes it easier to dive in. So yeah, whatever you're into, it's on Prime. From streaming to shopping, It's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever sparks interest. Amazon.com/Prime.
Game day or any day, your fit says it all. Hit up MLBShop.com for the latest jerseys, caps, hoodies, and accessories to keep you in the game all year long. Rep your team, rep your city, rep yourself. Gear up and game on at MLBShop.com, the official online shop of Major League Baseball. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Hate doing cardio? Try brushing and flossing your teeth. I'm not talking about building up a sweat. I'm talking about building a healthier mouth for a healthier heart, for a healthier you. Smile Generation trusted dentists look at your care through the lens of the mouth-body connection, because what happens in the mouth plays a critical role for the rest of your body. To find a dentist near you committed to treating all of you, visit smilegeneration.com/confidence today and live longer, healthier, and happier with Confidence Unleashed.